Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we get to talk with Dr. Paul Ostman about hospital ethics. And I know you were recently working on our inpatient service, and I've had some call coming up, and these are common, you know, common problems and situations that come up very often.
It seems like every day, almost every hour, there were so many problems and questions that come up that really could help, and we benefited because he rounded with us. So we'll get a chance to talk with him and talk about some of those cases.
Yeah, how to help us do the right thing for our patients.
Speaking of the right thing, we've got some research that matters about exercise program and heart failure.
About doctors who cook, maybe giving better nutrition advice.
About whether, if you have chronic kidney disease, does it matter what kind of diet you take?
And whether or not stress and anxiety is linked to sperm quality.
Say that one again.
Sperm quality, meaning the number
lifestyle.
And the swimming ability of those sperm.
Well, these are all lifestyle-related things, stress, anxiety, diet, nutrition, exercise. Let's dive right in, literally, about this very first study, Christy, about patients with chronic heart failure. Do they benefit from a chronic, long-term, structured exercise program?
So this was a study looking at those heart clubs or coronary clubs where patients who have heart disease go through this exercise training and healthy lifestyle change program. And they looked at 123 patients, average of 59 years, mostly men, who had stable chronic heart failure where the heart doesn't squeeze as well as a normal heart.
And basically, the patients who had this structured therapy with the cardiology and the exercise therapist and followed for up to 10 years really did significantly better. They had better scores in terms of their oxygen consumption, so getting more oxygen to their heart, and they had improvements in their quality of life, suggesting that the exercise program really had some long-term benefits to them.
It's true. It also showed reduced death from heart attacks or cardiac death and reduced hospital readmissions compared with the people who were just told to do their own physical activity without training on how to do it. So, I mean, it really does show a lot of potential. It makes me want to reinforce further with my patients who have heart failure to be sure they stay in that program.
Right. We think about cardiac rehab for patients who've had heart disease and pulmonary rehabilitation for patients with chronic lung disease. But we need to be thinking about cardiopulmonary rehabilitation for people with chronic heart and lung disease like these patients with heart failure.
Absolutely. This shows a lot of promise. The next study is about doctors and cooking. And Adam, you like to cook, don't you?
I do like to cook. You know, I like to talk about cooking with patients. Does that make me unusual, Christy?
No, I don't know if it's unusual or not.
What, do you like to cook?
Well, I do like to cook basic things, but I don't like to do fancy cooking.
You like macaroni and cheese, spaghetti?
Yeah, you know, chicken sausage and vegetables or something, but I'm not one of those people who loves to do fancy dinners.
And would you
dinners.
Feel comfortable talking with your patients about cooking?
I feel comfortable talking with them, and I'm probably more practical than a fancy cook,
It turns out that this particular study was looking at, in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine, what happens with people who get training about nutrition and cooking. Are they more confident about giving advice to patients about things like cooking?
Yeah, the study done at Harvard in connection with the Culinary Institute of America looked at 219 people before the conference and followed 192 of them 3 months after the conference in an anonymous survey just to see whether people cook differently and whether or not they counsel their patients differently.
And there weren't many changes in the percent of the participants, a little less than two-thirds that cooked their meals before or after. Though before the conference, many fewer said that they could counsel patients about dietary and cooking compared to afterwards. So there seemed to be a larger increase. But I frankly, Christy, found this study kind of wanting, kind of lacking. I was not real pleased.
Well, it doesn't actually show whether patients receive the counseling or the quality of the counseling, or best scenario would be a change in patient's behavior related to it. And pretty much any conference, any educational conference, you can see a benefit before and after, partly because we all think we got smarter by having taken our time.
And if it were you and I, Christy, we would have been smarter. But
that's right.
In addition to which, the lead author for this particular study had a little bit of a conflict of interest that served as a consultant to the Culinary Institute where this happened. And so I just had a little bit of worry that I'm not going to say, oh, just because I've gone to a Culinary Institute, I'm more qualified to counsel you about nutrition.
Right, or go out and require people to do it. But I do think doctors should make an effort to learn more because we have an opportunity to counsel our patients and try to make a difference.
Granted. Let's listen to our very next research that matters. A study that was in the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology, that's kidneys, about patients with chronic kidney disease. And are they better off taking a medication or having a diet?
So this was fascinating. They took 71 patients who had advanced chronic kidney disease from high blood pressure and put part of them on this oral alkaline medicine and another one of a group on eating large amounts of fruit and vegetables in their diet, and showed they're pretty equal.
Right. So normally patients who have these chronic kidney disease get acidotic. Their bodies don't work as well, the processes. And so they take medicines like Christy just mentioned to reverse that acidosis. And that's this chronic medication. But it turns out that perhaps vitamins, or in this case, vegetables and diet and fruit, can actually maybe do the same thing. And they found out that they were comparable.
I know. I mean, it's really promising that eating more fruits and vegetables reduces that metabolic acidosis you're talking about, or the acid in the body.
Because these fruits and vegetables are alkaline producing.
Exactly. And reduces the kidney injury in patients who already have some kidney disease, just as well as taking that supplemental therapy. So the bottom line is
we might actually offer patients a choice. Would you prefer to eat more fruits and vegetables as a way of taking care of some of this chronic kidney conditions, or would you be more like to take a medication? We could maybe offer a choice, so maybe we need a little more research first, or at least follow them.
I would agree we need more research, but I do think, I mean, how many studies do we keep showing saying eating more fruits and vegetables is good for you? So, I mean, there's not a lot of harm in recommending fruit and vegetables and many benefits. So for my patients with milder kidney disease, I would consider after this recommending a little more forcefully to eat more fruits and vegetables in general.
Sounds good to me.
All right.
Speaking about things that we might recommend, let's talk about our last research that matters. An article that was in the journal Fertility and Sterility about stress and anxiety.
Well, there have been some links between stress and anxiety and fertility for some time now, but this was a study looking to see more specifically if short increases in a man's stress and long-term anxiety had differing effects on people, on men, and their sperm counts and their ability of their sperm to swim effectively.
And so what they did in this study is they recruited 94 men who were going to the hospital's fertility clinic, and they compared them to 85 men who were not seeking fertility treatment. And they looked at the scores on anxiety and stress, and then looked at how those scores related to sperm concentration and counts. And in both groups, they actually found that the higher the stress level, the lower the sperm concentration, and the more likely those sperm were to be abnormal.
And when they looked at it, I mean, most of the men had normal sperm counts, and the difference between the sperm counts were still within the normal range. But it does really support the previous research that there is some link between how the body handles stress and anxiety with the quality and quantity of the sperm, and linked with fertility.
Right. It doesn't answer the question, do you become stressed from becoming infertile, or is the stress causing the infertility mm-hmm. fully? But it does suggest that those stress levels cannot help one in the fertility process. And so I think this says that for those who are undergoing infertility, that pay attention to the stress levels and work on cutting down on the anxiety levels. That can only be helpful.
Absolutely. So we've had a chance to talk about stress and anxiety linked to sperm quality.
About having more fruits and veggies as a way of cutting down potentially some of the chronic kidney problems with acidosis.
About a 10-year exercise program improving oxygen consumption, improving quality of life in patients with chronic heart failure.
And perhaps all of us, including doctors, need to become more understanding and proficient in cooking and understanding of nutrition. That'll conclude the Research That Matters. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Ostman about hospital ethics. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Paul Ostman about hospital ethics. And Dr. Ostman is assistant professor here at the University of North Carolina in the Department of Medicine. And his interests include hospital medicine, medical education, bioethics, and palliative care. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Ostman.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dr. Ostman, we are certainly glad to have you here for this conversation about hospital ethics. But before we jump in, we'd love to hear more about why something so challenging has been the thing that you have really taken on as a major interest in your career path.
It's something that started more as, I don't want to say a hobby, but something that I came to fairly naturally. I started doing some work with the Hospital Ethics Consult Service as a committee member, where I would see folks in consultation at the request of their primary team. And after doing that for some time, rose to a team leader where I would take the lead on these consults. And after doing some more work with training and reading, it's something that has become a major thrust in what I do on a day-to-day basis in the hospital.
So when we talk about hospital ethics, I think a lot of listeners out there would say, what are you talking about here? Because we know what a hospital is. We know what ethical situations are. But many listeners may not know that there are hospital ethics committees. What are they? How long have they been here in our lives?
And it's interesting because different hospitals, each committee will function differently. At largely Catholic hospitals, the ethics committee will have a very different role. So I'll speak to our work at UNC, where our work as a hospital ethics committee is threefold. We work with the hospital looking at policy work, where we help to develop policy that affects not just single patients, but the entirety of patients that the hospital will see. We also work with education, outreach to residents, faculty, staff. And then we all have the third thrust is acting as a consultative role, where we answer questions that are posed to us by teams that are having an ethical problem. What's interesting, I think, about ethics in general is many people think about ethics as a way to solve confrontation. And many times that's what the driver is for an ethics consult. But underneath that, I think, is a more broad role that I've been attracted to, which is what is our duty as a physician or any role in the healthcare process. And that, to me, is the more interesting part about bioethics and in turn, hospital ethics.
Well, let's highlight a specific case or give us an example where that duty has really come into play.
Mm-hmm. I think rather than a specific case, there are kind of patterns where there are certain facts that are well known, but there are certain value judgments by patients, by families, by providers that are sometimes in conflict or at least poorly communicated. And that's
so. What do you mean? Because I think one of my feelings sometimes as a provider who frequently would be utilizing your services are teaching providers exactly what do you mean? How are we going to benefit? So what are you really talking about when you talk about these types of things that come
sure.
up?
So sometimes it leads to a patient who wants to leave the hospital against medical advice.
Okay.
Other times it could be a case where a patient's prognosis is uncertain and the treatment options may be uncertain. And that leads to discomfort, that leads to difficulties in communication.
And how about, another common scenario might be if family members disagree over a decision about their loved one, if their mother is not able to talk for herself and is very ill, and then maybe the daughters disagree over how hard to keep fighting.
Mm-hmm.
How does the ethics committee come into play in that scenario, and how would you approach that?
I think in certain cases we would defer to more legal parameters, but I think the heart of it is reminding all those that are participating what their role is in the sense of what is best for this particular patient. Some of the confusing elements become technology, become just because we can, should we, just because we feel we should, is that still the right thing to do? Some of these take place with end of life, as you said, Christy, where certain family members may disagree. And in that case, I think everyone needs to be reminded that this is about a patient-physician interaction. This is not necessarily a legal matter. This is not necessarily a matter of what a physician might want to do for his or her mom or dad. It's what is right for this particular patient. And sometimes that takes some delving. Sometimes that takes some work to look at past preferences of a patient. That takes into account what is best practices within medicine. And getting everyone together, usually at the same table, and talking through those challenges.
Are frequently these types of discussions in the hospital setting about disagreements? So we had that case Christy just mentioned could be a disagreement between family members over what might be best for a loved one. There are disagreements between maybe providers and mm-hmm. patients about what treatment options maybe should be done or not. So I'm thinking of a patient who might suggest they want a feeding tube placed mm-hmm. for a loved one, and the provider says, well, there is no benefit to this. Are those types of disagreements at the crux sometimes of ethical dilemmas in hospitals?
At times where different providers, different teams may have disagreement, we're asked to help. And again, getting folks to think about that patient and what is maybe best for that patient, what are standards of practice, and
so what would you do in that particular circumstance? Let's say if you really, because that is a common situation mm-hmm. where whether it's a feeding tube or it could be a resuscitation, a cardiopulmonary resuscitation, where a patient may feel that they want that or want that for their loved one, and the provider says, I don't think this person will survive this. Mm-hmm. And you're at this logger jam. What do we do with that? Help.
I think it's best to take a step back and to stop thinking necessarily about where you're heading, but where you are right there and then. So asking each individual physician to define that moment, to making sure that patients and family members all understand that moment. And then at that point, look at what the options are. I generally like to limit it to three different options. One option is what we say kind of this full scope of very aggressive treatment where we try to maximize the halting of disease progression, which basically means we take for granted a patient's comfort and instead do everything we can to try to slow down a disease process. Obviously, the other avenue would be sacrificing some of the more standards of practice for longevity in favor of a more peaceful or a more comfortable existence. And then there's always the middle road where you try to maximize both as best you can. And many times when you break it down into those choices, this feeding tube fits into one of these three pathways. But I think putting the feeding tube first is the mistake. Instead of asking family and physicians what is best for this patient, whether they remain in the hospital versus going home. Do they want to maximize their chances to go home, or do they want to sacrifice that home life for more aggressive care?
Well, we are grateful that you're taking some time to talk with us and have many more questions about this complicated world of hospital ethics. But we need to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Paul Ostman from UNC Department of Medicine, about hospital ethics. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Paul Ostman from the University of North Carolina Department of Medicine about hospital ethics. And Dr. Ostman, before the break, we discussed a couple of scenarios of disagreement, misunderstanding between doctors and patients or between family members as one of the things that comes up often in your ethics consults. One of the things that raised for me, you mentioned technology, since we can do so many more things now, but also there's been an evolution in how we think about shared decision-making with patients. Can you summarize for us how that's maybe changed ethical dilemmas in the hospital setting?
I think whenever you think about shared decision-making, it's tough because you have to bring a career of knowledge from the physician side of things with a lifehood of experience on the patient side of things. And I don't think you can, I don't think as a provider you can truly understand what that patient is worried about, what their goals are. And at the same time, I think it's hard for a patient to understand all of the intricacies of medicine. But I do think at the very basis of this is truth-telling. At the very basis of the idea of shared decision-making is talking about the very, I guess talking about those decisions that are good decisions. And that a physician's duty is to lay out those choices that are reasonable and that are reflective of good medicine.
So do patients have in the work that you do, I mean, what do we do with common situation, a patient or the family feeling that they're not ready to be discharged from a hospital, mm-hmm. and providers saying, you are ready to be discharged from the hospital because what used to be 5 days in the hospital now sometimes is less than 24 hours. We've really condensed that hospital stay. What do we do with that?
I would want folks to get back to honesty. One of the things that does raise a red flag to me is when I hear very much like you said, it's time, the hospitals are a dangerous place, you need to go home. That is a very rooted in truth statement. Hospital-acquired infections are very real. Falls in the hospital certainly happen. But at the same time, there are multiple pressures placed on providers to get people out of the hospital and get them home. Some of them are utilitarian in basis. For every one person that's in the hospital, there's another person in the emergency department waiting room. And for every family member really wanting a bed for their loved one, there's another family member that is wondering if they're truly ready to be discharged. And my answer to that is what's best for the patient. And from a physician level, it's my strong belief that that needs to be grounded in that physician-patient relationship. And if that is not congruous with other factors, those other factors ought to be dealt with at a policy level and not at a bedside level. So as a physician myself, as well as someone on a hospital ethics committee, when that thought of this person needs to go home is raised, my immediate question is, what is best for this singular patient right now here in the hospital? And if it is in fact true that they would do better at home, then my advice is, quite frankly, to make that case as strong as you can, make that recommendation as strong as you can, and explain to that patient and that family the reason for it. If, in fact, it is not in that patient's best interest to go home and there are other external forces that are forcing you to make that decision is equally easy to make, but equally difficult to sometimes enact. And I would give anyone in that position full permission to do what is medically best. And then when it comes to policy decisions, looking at things on a population level, if there are reasons that make certain folks need to leave the hospital perhaps sooner than they're ready, thinking about this as a public policy, what can we do to make home better? What can we do to make leaving the hospital truly the safer thing to do?
Well, it sounds like in some ways you're an outside party coming in, reminding and reinforcing for the physicians to do the right thing for the patient, which is refreshing. One thing I wanted to touch on, I know you do a lot with doctors in training, our resident physicians, and thinking about curriculum and what things are most important for them to learn. What have you learned so far in your work of what providers need to know and maybe where we go wrong most often?
I think sometimes it's thinking about these issues in a way that is overly academic. Many times when I meet learners, when I am first meeting a team from an advisory role, the thought is that I'm going to be coming in from a very esoteric, very scholarly point and miss the entire point of why I'm there, and that is to think about things clinically and to bring what is a very academic pursuit and bring it to a very clinical scenario and keep it grounded.
Can you give an example of how that would work? Let's say if we were talking about sometimes talking about where clinicians, the team might disagree on a patient's quality of life mm-hmm. there. How would you turn that academic question into utilitarian for the team, where the team might have some disagreements and maybe and the learners?
So say that question.
So like a quality of life. So a team might feel that you might have a disagreement. One person on the team might think this patient doesn't have much quality of life, and the other person says, "Well, I don't know." And that could be a very academic discussion, and you want to make that real. How do you do that?
And again, after doing this for a few years, what I find most interesting is these discussions generally happen in the hallway. And I think it's good to bring these to the patient. There was one case in particular of a patient who's was literally stuck in the hospital. They did not have the ability to dialyze as an outpatient. So if they were to remain on dialysis, the only option was in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And the team was really worried about this person's quality of life. They said they seemed to be suffering here in the hospital. So I suggested, let's ask him. So we asked it, we just asked the
How
patient.
Creative.
Yeah. We just asked the patient, what's life like here in the hospital? And quite surprisingly to the team, he thought about it for a moment and gave a big grin and said, not too bad, and began to list how people treated him very well. People treated him with respect. He commented on the food. He commented on a few other things that were all quite good for him. And he understood that his life depended on dialysis, and dialysis depended on being in the hospital. Over time, he became more ill. Over time, he wished to go home. And he did return home on hospice, but it was more on his terms. And although it was a longer hospital stay than I think anyone expected, it was one that he retained his dignity throughout. And I'd like to think that he taught folks quite a bit through his hospital stay.
It sounds like a recurring theme in your work is talking with and listening to the patients themselves, and really reinforcing that with our young doctors who are doing their very best and probably spending more time, but needing to come back to, okay, well, let's actually put that question on the table.
I think so. And words are very powerful. And I don't like the idea of using two sets of words, one in a conference room and one at the bedside. Hmm. If a primary team is very distraught about offering a treatment that they feel is mean, or a treatment that is not medically sound but is wanted by the family, my advice to that team is to say that to the family. And many times that's the beginning of a very honest conversation about the limits of modern medicine and what we can truly do for a patient rather than to a patient.
Well, you know, this is a really fascinating discussion that we've been having with Dr. Paul Ostman about hospital ethics. And Dr. Ostman, I mean, I kind of feel like we could go on because there's so many questions. This is such an important topic. Maybe we can have you back on the show periodically to talk about interesting dilemmas, because I think in today's society, with the technology that you just described, we can do more, but is it always the right thing to do, and how do we decide that? So thank you so much for sharing your expertise and knowledge and compassion for this process with Your Health listeners.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have questions you'd like to address, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some wonderful House Calls today about chronic obstructive pulmonary disease,
about functional bowel disease,
about hepatitis C and cirrhosis,
and about a newborn baby with a small fever.
Well, let's listen to our very first House Call.
My mother has severe COPD. How long can most people live with such a bad disease?
I'm sorry.
I was going to say the same thing. It's sorry to hear that your mother has such bad lung disease. We should define COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. People think of it along the lines as emphysema or chronic bronchitis, and think of it in its lung disease, mostly from smoking, but from other reasons too.
Yeah, like 80 to 90% from smoking or exposure to secondhand smoke, though there are cases where it's not, and it could be due to genetic reasons or deficiencies. And it is one of the, if not the top reason for people to get admitted to the hospital. And I think it's like one of the second, third, fourth leading cause of death around the world. This is a growing epidemic. And so your mother isn't alone. And we have good news and bad news, I guess.
I mean, the good news is for people who are caught early in stage one or early on, that 90% of them live at least 5 years. So catching it early and getting on medications early is a really good thing.
And the big treatment there is to quit smoking if you are smoking, or quit being exposed to secondhand smoke, because that can help limit some of that damage. But the bad news is that if you have the most severe form, we call that your pulmonary function test, stage four, those is the mortality, the death rate goes up pretty dramatically after 5 years. So almost two-thirds don't live after 5 years when you have the severe COPD.
And about 65% die within 2 years of that stage four, or 60% are still alive at 2 years.
So 30 to 40% could be die. So this, it's not a good diagnosis, but hopefully knowing that it's not something that she should die from immediately, and also that there are treatments, and there are a lot of research going into this. So really talk with your family doctor, talk with your pulmonologist, and hopefully there's a good team taking care of her. Thank you so much for that very good question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
I'm 32, and I was told I have functional bowel disease. What does that really mean? Is it a fancy way of saying it is all in my head?
Functional bowel disease, that is that's unfortunate, and it's especially difficult if you feel like there's some accusation or implication that it's just all in your head, because people who have this problem have real symptoms.
And, you know, kudos actually to the doctor who kind of diagnosed this, because sometimes doctors would say, you know, that we don't really know. But functional bowel disease is actually a group of disorders, and some people have heard of irritable bowel syndrome, and that's one type of functional bowel problems. But there's also things called non-cardiac chest pain, or chronic functional abdominal pain, or even functional constipation. It's a group of disorders. We don't understand it a whole lot, but we understand it better than we did.
And what we can say is that it describes a group of problems with how your stomach and your bowels function, how they feel, how they work, where we're not able to find any problems with your organs or any, if you do a colonoscopy with biopsies, it doesn't show any of those severe inflammatory bowel problems like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or one of these other things.
Which is a good thing.
It's good to not have those things, for sure, but where we can't necessarily find anything wrong with your organs.
But your pain is real, and we
exactly
understand that. And so you're going to have to work again with the team, with your primary care doctor, with the nutritionist, with maybe even a psychologist to help manage this and help manage the pain. Good luck. Thank you again for a very good question. Let's listen, Christy, to our next house call about hepatitis C and cirrhosis.
I have hepatitis C and cirrhosis of my liver. I've had this for a year, but I'm doing okay. Could I get a liver transplant?
Well, it's good news that you're doing well after a year, and we're sorry that you had this very difficult diagnosis. In terms of a liver transplant, it depends on how sick you are, and there are all these different ways that scores and things about your lab values and your body and how it's functioning that determine where people fall on the wait list.
Yeah, so most people who've had hepatitis C and have developed cirrhosis probably have had it for longer than a year. You mm-hmm. may not have found out about it till late in the game, but people can go a pretty long time actually with cirrhosis without developing necessarily the kind of the life-threatening problems. And that's one of the conditions that would really lead to a liver transplant, is if you've had recent development of liver disease and we're in the intensive care unit and your life expectancy is 7 days or fewer, you go to the top of that line for a liver transplant, because liver transplants are not easy to come by. And then there's other criteria and ways of understanding it, this MELD score and a PELD score, M-E-L-D and P-E-L-D.
And those are based on the risk or the probability of dying within 3 months for a person who doesn't receive a transplant. So it's pretty complicated. The people who are not eligible are people who are continuing to drink, because unfortunately, alcohol and substance abuse is a very common cause for liver problems.
If you have advanced heart or lung disease or cancer other than locally confined to the liver, you won't be eligible for a liver transplant either.
Well, we certainly hope that that you are eligible, and also want to offer there is a lot of good news around the diagnosis of hepatitis C these days. There are new treatments, even cures, that are coming out for patients. So there's a lot of hope around this illness.
We'll have our health sciences librarians also flag some resources about hepatitis C and liver transplantation to put on our website.
Let's take our very last house call about a newborn baby.
Does a newborn baby with a small fever that is really doing well with feeding have to go to the hospital?
Well, first off, we're so glad that the baby is doing really well. And like many questions, we have one question right back at you. What's the actual temperature?
That's
right. Because fever can mean different things to different people.
That's exactly right. We define a fever as over 100.4 when taken rectally in a baby. And so for a newborn baby, if the baby has a fever over 100.4 when taken rectally, then yes, they really should go to the hospital. And that's just because they're at risk for getting bacteria in their blood that can cause very, very dangerous infection and can just be devastating to a baby. And so they can't tell us in the same way that older children and grown-ups can. So if they have a fever in that newborn period, as much as you don't want to, yes, you should take them to get checked out.
In that newborn period, we'd usually describe as less than 3 months. You know, if the child's 6 months old, we may not call them a newborn. And they may, if they're doing well, then we look at this a little differently.
Mm-hmm. And 4 to 6 weeks is really that critical. If they're younger than that, I wouldn't mess around at all and get that baby checked out. Congratulations to you on having a new baby, and hopefully things continue to go great.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, Christy. And we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today on Your Health. They can send us questions. Anyone can. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
And you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, get our health app through iTunes by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Paul Ostman. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We can't wait to talk with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.